It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Police departments across the state, in Pittsburgh, and around the country employ security cameras to help solve or even discourage crimes if they are visible to the public. But district attorneys rarely do. Allegheny County District Attorney Stephen Zappala has created his own network of surveillance cameras. What is he doing with the data? Are there privacy concerns? Mike Warshaken is an investigative reporter with the Caucus. Mike, welcome back to the Confluence.
Always a pleasure, Kevin.
Mike, how much did you know about how these cameras were being used and how extensive a network there was going into your investigation?
Very, very little. I knew that there had been some concern about the spread of this technology and these cameras. And, you know, people have been worried about this idea of a surveillance state for a while, that really you can't go anywhere privately, you can be tracked places. But I wasn't aware that that there was a network like this operating in Allegheny County.
So whenever you have surveillance, as you alluded to, you have questions about privacy. What data is being gathered and for how long is it stored?
Right now, many of these cameras, and this is a network of about 1,000 cameras in around 100 locations in Allegheny County and four surrounding counties. Many of these, of those thousand cameras have automated license plate recognition capability. And so when you drive past one of these, they snap a picture of your license plate, they can store it in a database, and they hold on to it for up to about 6 months.
Mm-hmm. So how useful is this for information? What is the DA's office telling you its purpose?
They say it's incredibly useful. They have used this to help solve kidnappings, hit-and-run accidents, thefts, all sorts of things. They've helped locate elderly people who've wandered away. This is a technology that law enforcement says has been critical to solving some crimes.
So how extensive is Zappala's camera network? What areas does it cover?
The exact areas, we're not sure, because they're not saying. As I mentioned, it's about 1,000 cameras in 100 locations centered in Allegheny County, but it also has in recent years spread into Beaver, Butler, Washington, and Westmoreland counties with the knowledge and cooperation of their district attorneys there. So it covers a pretty big area. They're collecting millions upon millions of license plates every week.
So worst case scenario, how could this possibly cause problems?
Well, privacy advocates will tell you that they're a little nervous that somebody can punch in a license plate and track your movements over the past 6 months. By just searching for a license plate number, they can recreate your movement. They can, you know, sort of follow what you've been doing, where you've been going, and you know that's you don't necessarily have to be doing something illegal for you to not want people to know where you're going, for it to be a private matter. Say it's a doctor's appointment. Say, you know, it's religious services, or it makes people a little nervous.
Would those potential problems be true of any camera network, or are they unique to Mr. Zappala's?
They're not unique to the district attorneys. But what really amps this up a bit is the automated component of it. The introduction of artificial intelligence to do more than a human could do by themselves. And that's what enables them to search for 6 months worth of work or of movement.
Have you found any other district attorneys who have set up camera networks? Just how unusual is this?
The people that I talk to who research this and who know, you know, awful lot more about it than I do have said that this is unique. They have never seen a district attorney set up a camera network like this. Usually when this happens, it's set up by a police department. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, these automated technologies are being increasingly deployed, but they're being deployed by cops, not mm-hmm. by prosecutors.
What information that you were able to dig up for your piece, just how difficult was it to get data? Was it difficult to get data from the DA's office?
Yeah, they're being pretty tight-lipped about this. We filed a right-to-know law request back in March, I believe, and we've been sort of going back and forth with them ever since. They sent a response to us with some details about the camera network, but what they did was they redacted the specific equipment that they purchased with it. Mm-hmm. And so you have whole pages that are just blacked out. So they'll tell you how much they spent, but they won't tell you what they spent it on exactly, or who they spent it on.
So you've gotten this correspondence, these replies from the DA's office. Did Stephen Zappala speak with you for your reporting?
No, he did not. I corresponded with the Right to Know Law officer and with his spokesman, Mike Mankow.
Our guest on The Confluence is Mike Wershagen, an investigative reporter for The Caucus. We're talking about his story published today in The Caucus about a surveillance camera network set up by District Attorney Stephen Zappala in Allegheny County. Mike, you report the cameras were purchased from Chinese manufacturers. National security experts, including the Department of Defense, have an issue with that. Why?
Well, two of the manufacturers that they purchased are these Chinese manufacturers, and those manufacturers are specifically listed in the 2019 National Defense Authorization Act as national security threats. The reason for that is they have security vulnerabilities, or they have close ties to the companies that make them have very close ties to the Chinese government, which, you know, from an intelligence perspective, is an adversarial nation. Mm-hmm. And we've had issues with Chinese intelligence trying to break into systems in the United States for a long time. So what Congress said was no federal installation can have these things. And if you are a federal agency, you're not allowed to contract with somebody mm-hmm. who uses these cameras, because we don't trust that because they allow a door into the network. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. These are Wi-Fi connected cameras. So the danger is that if you can get into the camera through some vulnerability, you don't just have access to the camera. You have access to the network the camera is connected to. It's like think of a literal back door on a building. Mm-hmm. If all the security is standing in front and you walk in through the back, you're not stuck on the threshold. You can go anywhere you want in the building.
Right. And they're just not close ties. I believe the Chinese government is a majority owner of one of the companies that manufactures these cameras.
Yeah, not just that. The company is Hikvision. The Chinese government is the largest stakeholder in that company. The company itself is a subsidiary of a fully state-owned defense contractor that exists to manufacture electronics for the Chinese military.
So these backdoors, these flaws that a cybersecurity company found in the network, not necessarily Stephen Zappala's network, but other for a company, I believe they were investigating.
Yes.
The security. Are they accidental, intentional? What do we know?
So depends who you ask. If you ask the company, they'll tell you, no, this was an accident. We patched the security flaw. But the person I spoke to who found one of these vulnerabilities said that this is not accidental. They've seen accidental vulnerabilities. And what usually happens is some engineer is working on the software and they want to run some tests. And so they slip in a piece of code that lets them get in and out of the camera very easily. And then they just forget to delete it when their part of the job is done. And that's what security patches fix. They fix those little mistakes. This was buried. This was buried in such a way that it looked to have been put there deliberately. And the person who found this is a former NSA analyst, a National Security Agency analyst, right, who now runs a kind of a white hat hacking firm, mm-hmm. where companies hire him and say, you know, find the vulnerabilities in our network so we can close them off. Well, he found this one and alerted the company. And it turned out that the company had an awful lot of traffic going to Chinese IP addresses.
Mm. What did the DA's office say about the vulnerability of the system?
They said they're not really concerned about it, that hacking is not a major concern, and that if you were to get into these camera networks, you could really only look at the images. Now, we're not exactly sure about that because we don't know much about the network. One of the other very strange things about this is that it's being monitored by a private company.
So you have equipment purchased from Chinese manufacturers, and the data is being monitored by an outsourced company.
And they won't tell us who the company is, because they say that the network is so vulnerable that if they were to tell us, then the company and the cameras would become targets for hackers.
There's another element, the potential for facial recognition. Is facial recognition being used now?
No, it is not. According to Mike Manko, the district attorney spokesperson, the facial recognition capabilities have not been activated. But according to the project manager for this, Dick Scringer, that is going to be coming down the road. Now, Mike Manko says there are no plans right now. There have been discussions. So it's a little unclear where exactly this stands.
And part of that, from your reporting, is the potential for tracking students on probation?
That was what Mr. Scringer said. Yeah, he told a group of downtown, told a downtown forum, the Downtown Clean and Safe Community Forum, that they have photographs of 2,000 school students who are on probation, and that once facial recognition, the capability is activated, they can feed those photos into the system, and as he put it, keep them out of areas they're not supposed to be in.
Our guest on The Confluence is Mike Wershak, an investigative reporter for the caucus. So why invest in cameras with facial recognition if you're not going to use it?
That's the big question. And that's something that that some of the security experts and the surveillance experts that I spoke to had raised, is that if you're not going to use this, why are you buying the equipment that enables it? So there is, you know, like I said, that's a little unclear. They're saying that we have no plans to use it. But other parts of the same organization, the same office, is saying that, yeah, that's coming down the road.
Mike, starting today, there's a ban on federal entities from buying Chinese-made surveillance equipment, part of the National Defense Authorization Act. Does this apply to local government agencies, entities such as the county DA's office?
Not directly. Okay. It does apply indirectly in the sense that they cannot use federal funds to purchase these cameras or to use them. It also applies indirectly in the sense that they are... their federal agencies aren't supposed to contract with these entities that use these cameras.
Very briefly, legislation pending in the House Transportation Committee that addresses surveillance cameras, what would it do?
It would place some limits on license plate recognition technology, and it would also set up a fund to help municipalities purchase these cameras, because like I said, you know, like we were talking about at the beginning, this is something law enforcement agencies say is very, very useful for them.
All right, so not stop it, limits, restrictions, but we're going to help you buy it.
Right.
Okay. So finally, Mike, what are some of the questions regarding the surveillance network operated by the DA's office that you still are seeking answers for?
Well, I want some clarity on this facial recognition question. I'm also curious about the policies governing the use of these cameras, which do not exist in writing as far as we can tell. We asked for them what the written policies are, but that we were told that these agreements with police departments for access to the network are all oral.
Mike Wershagen is investigative reporter for the caucus. Mike, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. Still ahead on The Confluence, President Trump is in western Pennsylvania today, touring an ethane cracker plant in Beaver County. The White House says the trip will promote his economic agenda, but many Pennsylvania advocates note Shell's move into Potter Township was in the works long before Trump got into politics. A seminar in Pittsburgh yesterday explored the ways healthcare professionals can better center the needs of transgender people, and a collection of vintage World War II aircraft will be on display in Butler this week as part of a nationwide tour. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
Curtis Mayfield was supposed to perform for a crowd in Brooklyn on this day in 1990, but hadn't even sung one note when the show was abruptly ended. As Mayfield took to the stage, a lighting rig hanging above him came loose and fell on the singer, paralyzing him from the neck down. Despite this major setback, the Superfly singer continued to record new music until his death from diabetes in 1999. Mayfield is one of a handful of artists who are inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame twice, once on his own and once with his old singing group, The Impressions. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Fentanyl is an extremely potent opioid. People often ingest it or inject it without knowing and die as a result. Public health workers say test strips can help a person determine if fentanyl is present in an illicit substance and then use it more carefully. But 90.5 WESA's Sarah Bowden reports that because fentanyl test strips are classified as drug paraphernalia, they are illegal in Pennsylvania.
Dave Letrick walks over to a group of men who are homeless and camped out under a bridge on Pittsburgh's south side. He hands someone a cigarette and crouches down to greet one of the group's dogs. In his truck on the way there, Letrick told me a lot of the people he works with have lived traumatic lives.
And substances are a part of their lives because of that suffering. That suffering isn't necessarily in their lives because of the substance.
Letrick is the executive director of Bridge to the Mountains. The street outreach organization connects people to resources like housing and distributes naloxone or Narcan, the medication that can revive someone from an opioid overdose. Letrick would like to do more to prevent accidental overdose deaths.
If we could legally hand out test strips, we'd do it in a heartbeat.
To use a fentanyl test strip, you dilute a very small amount of a drug into a cup of water and dip the strip into the cup. If fentanyl is present, two lines appear. Mike Kravick works for a nonprofit that provides substance use and addiction treatment services in Armstrong, Clarion, and Indiana counties. He says people know drugs are dangerous. That doesn't stop them from using, so at least public health workers can help people stay alive.
Doing things like providing naloxone or giving out these fentanyl test strips will be able to reach a population of people that otherwise aren't walking in the doors to our offices because they're not necessarily ready to seek out treatment services yet.
I couldn't find a Pennsylvania law enforcement agency that's charged someone with possession of paraphernalia for having a test strip. But Kravick's organization covers so many municipalities in rural Pennsylvania, he's not willing to risk ending up on the wrong side of the law.
Especially because public officials change over time. So what if there's a change in the top law enforcement officer in that town, you know, 6 months or a year down the road?
But one Philadelphia business owner is willing to take that chance.
The drug epidemic in Philly is so intense in certain parts of the city that I think that this kind of falls in like the lower end of the scale of their interest.
Carrie Germindo co-owns Common Beat Music, an equipment repair and record shop. She started stocking a small supply of test strips at her store after someone she knew fatally overdosed.
I ask for a donation of a dollar or two just to cover my cost because I pay for it out of my pocket. But no one's ever been turned away for not having any money for it.
Grimindel says if a person knows their heroin, cocaine, or any other substance contains fentanyl, they're more likely to use a smaller amount, not use that drug alone, and also make sure naloxone, the medication that can revive someone from an overdose, is nearby. Moore might soon be joining Grimindel in supplying fentanyl test strips. Last month, Republican State Representative James Struzzi of Indiana County introduced legislation that would legalize fentanyl test strips. Struzzi said that because the opioid epidemic has reached, quote, catastrophic levels, legalizing test strips will save lives. I'm Sarah Bowden, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. Like everyone else, people who identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender need consistent, compassionate medical care. But unlike the general population, many in the trans community say they often have to teach their healthcare providers what their identities mean. A seminar in Pittsburgh Monday explored the ways healthcare professionals can better center these needs for the trans population specifically. 90.5 WESA's Kathleen J. Davis was there. Kathleen, welcome back to The Confluence.
Thank you for having me.
So the one-day conference was at the University of Pittsburgh in Oakland. What did participants talk about?
Yeah, so there were a few different speakers. A couple of them spoke about the history of how the trans population has been treated by medical providers, I mean, going back to like the 1800s, so a while ago to now. And then there were also some speakers who spoke about how healthcare providers today can better accommodate and treat their patients who are trans and what to say, what not to say. So it was really educational and interesting.
To clarify, this was for doctors, nurses, social workers, mental health care workers. That sounds sort of unique. Doctors are supposed to know where you're coming from, but for lots of people, it sounds like maybe that hasn't been the case.
Yeah. So there was actually this survey that was done in 2015 that was very interesting, and it was about a wide variety of things. But one of the points that came out that I found really striking in this survey was that a third of survey respondents said that they had had at least one negative experience with a healthcare provider within a year of taking that survey. And that could be either that a healthcare provider wouldn't treat them because of their gender identity, or that they were harassed by a healthcare provider. So a third of these patients, that's a lot of people, and that's an experience, unfortunately, that a lot of trans people share.
And that sounds like the more extreme case, but it could also lead to, I guess, less extreme measures like postponing medical care.
Definitely.
Or just not getting preventative care.
Yeah, definitely. I think that same survey said about 25% of the trans respondents said that they had not sought medical care in the last year when they needed to because they were worried about something like that happening.
So what was the mood like in the room then? Were the healthcare providers themselves especially receptive?
I think so. There were definitely several dozen people there, a majority of them healthcare providers, and everybody was very attentive and eager to learn is the sense that I got.
So I guess a self-isolating group, that's a great start, but maybe not enough to move the dial too much. Are you hearing anything from these doctors, whether they're taking the step to educate themselves or others going forward?
I think so. I mean, definitely one of the big takeaways of the conference was that healthcare providers need to educate themselves because their patients don't want to or shouldn't be the ones who are educating their doctors. You know, it's not their responsibility necessarily, or it shouldn't be. Another thing that was really hammered home by some of the speakers was that it's important to kind of open the floor to these patients, specifically in asking them how they like to be identified. So asking, you know, what is your preferred name? What are your preferred pronouns? Things that really aren't that big really make a big difference for these patients and make them feel more welcome.
Kathleen J. Davis is a reporter here at WESA. Kathleen, thanks for making time.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Living History is coming to Butler this week with the arrival of the Wings of Freedom tour, including rare World War II aircraft. Hunter Cheney is the director of marketing for the Collings Foundation, which organizes and presents historical artifacts for Americans to view and to learn about. Hunter, welcome to the Confluence.
Hi, Kevin. Thank you for having me.
There will be bombers and fighters on display at the Butler Regional Airport Thursday through Sunday. Did these aircraft see action during World War II, or were they more World War II era?
Some of them actually did see combat during World War II. This tour, think of this tour kind of like as an interactive flying memorial for our World War II veterans. So this tour features three bombers and two fighters from World War II. So the one true combat aircraft we have in this grouping is a very rare heavy bomber called a B-24 Liberator. It's the most mass-produced multi-engine aircraft in American history. So in the course of World War II, over 18,000 of these aircraft were made. And this particular four-engine heavy bomber was transferred to the Royal Air Force, the RAF, and they took this plane down through the Pacific Theater, and they did bombing missions and supply missions all the way up the Pacific chain, eventually ending in India. And that's where, at the end of World War II, the plane sat.
Is that the one you have now, or is that...
It is. It's the one that's on tour now. And the incredible thing about it is it's the last fully restored aircraft of this type flying in the world.
Is this the model that was used in the Doolittle raid, or was that another bomber?
So the aircraft, the really iconic mid-range bomber that was used during the Doolittle raid, is called a B-25 Mitchell. And that's the aircraft that we have, the type of aircraft that we have out on tour as well. The B-25 Mitchell was made famous by this one mission that Jim Doolittle and the Raiders did right after the United States was attacked, of course, at Pearl Harbor. So Jim Doolittle came up with this very, very risky, highly dangerous mission to fly this mid-range bomber off an aircraft carrier to bomb Japan.
They didn't have the range to return, did they?
No, it was a one-way trip. So the plan was that they were to fly off the USS Hornet and bomb Japan and then continue on into China, hopefully making it into friendly territory where they would basically find some place to land. And it really didn't work out that way for a lot of the raiders.
Let's talk about one of the stars, if not the star of the show. I think many of us have heard of the B-17. Why was it called the Flying Fortress?
Well, that's just what it was thought of, was a fortress. And the reason for that is there were 10 gunning positions in the aircraft. So the B-17 Flying Fortress is a very iconic and probably, as you had noted, one of the most well-known heavy bombers of World War II. And I think a lot of that is attributed to, you might remember, 12 O'Clock High and Memphis Belle. That's this plane.
12 O'Clock High, the movie starring Gregory Peck, of course, right?
Yes, that's right. And this is one of, I believe it's approximately 9 flying now in the world. And again, just like the B-25 and the B-24, these planes are fully restored back to their original condition from 1944. So when you're going inside the aircraft, when you're looking around, you see all the oxygen canisters up and the wires and the guns and everything in there is just how had it been over 70 years ago. It's kind of like walking into a time machine.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We're talking to Hunter Cheney with the Wings of Freedom aircraft tour coming to Butler this weekend. The bombers, they're impressive because of their size. What about their little brothers that served as escorts, the fighters? And you have a new fighter this time around, I believe.
We do. So the two fighters we have is the P-51 Mustang and the P-40 Warhawk. The P-40 was our primary fighter aircraft. So this was the one fighter that we had that we used primarily as a fighter when we entered World War II. This is a new addition for us. So for years now, we have been restoring this P-40 Warhawk into a two-seat trainer version of the original fighter. When people fly in this plane, you have the pilot instructor in the front, and then you have what's called a trainee or a student pilot in the back. And we call it that because when you fly in this plane, you literally are a trainee. You get flight instruction from a certified pilot instructor to fly this plane.
Are you talking about visitors or somebody that wants to be a student pilot?
Both. So people who've never flown planes before, never been in an aircraft to experience pilots, get flight instruction in this aircraft. And it is a kick.
Hunter, I understand this is the 30th year of the nationwide tour. A couple of generations have had the chance to experience these aircraft. Why is that important?
World War II is the worst, most horrific, and trying time that we as humans had to endure in basically the history of this planet. What we had done back over 30 years ago when we started to restore these aircraft as an educational foundation, our primary objective, of course, is to engage people in history, not only as a means to better understand it, but motivation to want to learn more. When people come out to tour through these aircraft, you really are getting a tactile history lesson.
The cross-country tour, it's also a salute to the men and women who served with these aircraft. Are there many vets that are of that era that are able to maybe make it out to the tour stops? Or is it maybe their children, their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren?
Yeah, we're seeing nowadays, unfortunately, we're seeing the extended families come out to honor their grandfathers and grandmothers and great-grandfathers, great-grandmothers who served in World War II. In Butler, particular, what's really nice about our stay up there is we often do see a couple veterans that come out to visit. You know, the chances of seeing a World War II veteran out are getting increasingly more rare, and this generation's quickly passing.
So tours inside the aircraft, what does that entail? Can you sit in the pilot seat? What can you do?
So we have all five aircraft out on display, and the two aircraft that we have where you can crawl through the inside of them is the B-17 Flying Fortress and the B-24 Liberator. So here you have the opportunity to get inside the aircraft and at least have you get right up to the cockpit. And then we have the B-25 and the P-40 and the P-51 are out on display. So you can get right up next to the aircraft. You just can't crawl through the inside of them or on top of them just due to the size of the aircraft. And the walkthrough tours, we have more current veterans and crew and staff that act as docents. So when you go through the aircraft, you can hear the stories and histories behind the aircraft and what they represent. And then we do flight operations in the aircraft. And so people also have a chance to see the planes operating as well. Of course, there's a fee behind it. 100% of the proceeds go right back into the operation of the aircraft.
So who is more excited, the adults or the kids, when they see and go inside these vintage aircraft?
The kids are more awestruck of their construction, and the adults love them because, of course, they have a slightly better understanding as far as what they represent and the rarity of the aircraft themselves.
Hunter Cheney is the director of marketing for the Collings Foundation, which organizes and presents the Wings of Freedom tour that's coming to Butler Regional Airport Thursday through Sunday. Thanks for taking the time.
An absolute pleasure. Thank you.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. President Trump is in the Pittsburgh area today to tour the $6 billion petrochemical cracker plant that is under construction in Beaver County. According to the White House, the president will focus on his economic agenda, but nearby protests are expected. Let's get a preview with reporter Reed Frazier from our partners, State Impact Pennsylvania and the Allegheny Front. Reed covers energy and environmental issues. Welcome, Reed.
Hi, Kevin.
So Trump is expected in Potter Township by early afternoon. What do we expect to hear from the president?
You would imagine he's going to talk about job creation and the state of the economy right now, where unemployment is very low, and about his overall agenda to promote the economy partially by slashing environmental regulations, which is something his administration has done a lot of.
So why Shell? Why this plant? Why the Pittsburgh area?
Well, we don't have a crystal ball. We can't see into the mind of whoever set this trip up, but it seems like a no-brainer. You know, Western Pennsylvania is going to be very contested ground in the 2020 election. You know, this is a project there where they're bringing in thousands of workers to build this thing, and it's politicians of every stripe have, you know, Tom Wolf has camped out there and, you know, talked about its benefits. So it's a popular, you know, sort of a broadly popular project in this part of the state. So it's a good way for him to get his points out there.
The cracker plant seems to be a good fit for the president's economic and energy strategies policies.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, I guess we'll get into what the cracker plant is. You know, it's coming out of the oil and gas industry. You know, you have this byproduct called ethane, and the chemical companies use this ethane to make plastic. But you can't just build a small plant to do this. It has to be very large, and Shell is building that in Beaver County.
And that plant, that process is sort of an important link in the gas line industry?
Yeah. I mean, so right now, ethane, there's too much of it in Western Pennsylvania for anybody here to use to make petrochemicals and plastics. So it's getting shipped out of the region to the Gulf Coast. Some of it's going to Canada, and some of it's going overseas right now to chemical plants there. So this is a way for the chemical industry to sort of set up shop in Western Pennsylvania.
Of course, construction began shortly after Donald Trump became president in 2017, but it had been in the works for years, this plant.
Yeah, Shell kind of made the decision in 2012 to explore this, the Beaver County site, and then they made their final decision in 2016 while President Obama was president. They were lured here by a very large $1.6 billion tax break that the Corbett administration, a Republican administration, had put into place.
In addition to talking about his energy and economic plans, is this trip politically advantageous? Because the area is part of Donald Trump's base.
I mean, this is, if he's going to win, he needs to win a lot of the folks in this region. You know, this is a project that's very popular with the trade unions in Western PA for obvious reasons. They're getting a lot of work. And Trump, I think it's widely acknowledged that he needs sort of sometimes Democratic voters who are, you know, are either in union families or sympathetic to the union, to union jobs, to kind of vote for him because of he's promoting manufacturing and helping the economy.
And as you allude to, Pennsylvania will likely be a swing state again. Protesters are expected nearby. What are you hearing about the demonstrations? Are anti-Trump in general, or is their message more about his environmental policies?
I think the message that I've seen so far from the protest movement has been more about the local impacts of this particular facility. I mean, you could apply that broadly to Trump's entire deregulatory agenda, but they cite, you know, large amounts of air pollution that this plant will be permitted to emit, lots of CO2, the main ingredient in climate change, which the president has in the past denied exists or is called a hoax. So there's sort of a broad array of environmental reasons why this plant is getting protested today.
What's the status of legal challenges either to the plant or to the administration's regulation rollbacks?
Well, the plant is, you know, all of its permits are sort of in place, so it's kind of full speed ahead on construction there. There are numerous lawsuits against many of the rollbacks from the Trump administration, but they are, you know, and they're in varying stages of completion. So a lot of pushback on it, but nothing's set in stone yet.
When is the projected time for completion and to be online?
Well, there's no set date for sure right now, but they're saying the early 2020s. So, you know, 2-3 years, you could see this thing creating plastic.
And approximately how many permanent jobs has the company been estimating?
Well, there's about 5,000 workers on site right now, Shell is reporting. The permanent jobs are going to be considerably lower. You don't need that many people to run these plants while they're up. So it's about 600 permanent jobs. There are, will, of course, be other jobs in the region that are influenced by the presence of this plant.
And supporters of the plant say this will have a ripple effect in creating other jobs or help other industries?
There's likely going to be other ethane crackers in the region. There could be other companies that decide to build plants nearby to process some of the chemicals and byproducts that come out of this plant. So, you know, we've seen that in other regions with big chemical plants. So there's a reason to think that that might happen here, too.
And to use the plastics that will be created by this plant.
To use the plastics, sometimes these plants create sort of byproduct things that are, you know, maybe not as portable, like gases or liquids that have to be stored under pressure. So those might make more sense to locate here. The plastics, honestly, could be transported anywhere in the world.
And Reid, briefly, what will you be listening for?
I want to hear, are there any policies that he's going to roll out or sort of unveil? And I also want to see if there's a preview for the 2020 campaign somewhere in this message.
Reid Frazier covers energy and the economy for the Allegheny Front, State Impact Pennsylvania, and the Trump on Earth podcast. Reid, thanks so much for joining us today, and stay dry out there.
Thank you, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, it's been 1 year since the release of the grand jury report about child sexual abuse by Catholic priests in Pennsylvania. A talk with Attorney General Josh Shapiro. And many schools will employ active shooter drills to try to enhance safety. We'll explore how those drills impact children. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered by Tom Hurley and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Julia Zenkovich, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.